Welcome to Canada Conversations, part of Delaware Debates 2020, produced by Delaware Public Media in collaboration with the University of Delaware's Center for Political Communication. I'm Delaware Public Media News Director Tom Byrne. This conversation focuses on the race for U.S. Senate, and we are joined by the incumbent Democratic Senator Chris Coons. Chris, thanks for joining us on Canada Conversations.
Thank you, Tom, and my thanks to Delaware Public Media and to everyone who's listening.
Let's start with why you are running for another term, what you hope to accomplish in another term as Delaware's U.S. Senator.
Well, I'm grateful to have had the chance to represent Delaware for 10 years, but I think we're at a critical moment. We have three different crises bearing down on the American people at the same time. A global health pandemic that has gotten far worse than it ever should have been. A resulting recession, which has thrown tens of millions of Americans out of work and is a real struggle for thousands of Delaware families facing eviction, facing foreclosure, facing a job loss, and having challenges in terms of reopening schools. And then a renewed nationwide focus on racial inequality and injustice. I've got the skills, the capability, the values to contribute to solving or addressing all three of them. Hopefully, we will have a Biden presidency in January, and I'll be part of the majority in the Senate. And in that case, I'd have a role where I'd be hopefully significantly contributing to moving legislation that would address both these three current crises, racial inequality, economic recession, and the pandemic, but also going to address some of the things that were on my plate and were crises before. So we still have an opioid addiction problem in our country that took 70,000 lives last year. We still have an epidemic of gun violence that took 30,000 American lives last year. And we have climate change bearing down on our planet. So there are lots of things to do. I've worked hard in a decade to both reach across the aisle and pass pragmatic legislation where possible, but also to introduce prophetic legislation, legislation I know isn't going to pass right now, but that shows the way forward on big issues like climate or gun violence.
I want to talk about a lot of the issues that you kind of name-checked there, but first I do want to ask you, you also mentioned qualifications. I'm curious what you think voters should know about you and your work in the Senate that perhaps they don't already know about.
Well, Tom, I serve on five different committees. I serve on the Small Business Committee, and that's recently been one of the most active as we've worked hard to deliver support for small businesses and nonprofits in the context of this pandemic. Folks may not realize that that's something that I've put a huge amount of time and effort into. I work on intellectual property, the subcommittee of Judiciary, where I'm the ranking member. We've done dozens of hearings. And again, that's not something that's ever top of the headlines. But protecting America's inventors and creators, whether it's songwriters or filmmakers, or whether it's inventors and innovators who have patents, I've done a fair amount of legislating in that field that I think helps Delaware and helps our country. I'm the vice chairman of the Ethics Committee. I can't talk about the work of that committee, but it's the only truly bipartisan committee. It's an equal number of Democrats and Republicans. And we've had some very challenging cases recently. And then, of course, I think I'm best known for being on the Judiciary Committee and the Foreign Relations Committee and the Appropriations Committee. I'm a part of the leadership of the Democratic Caucus. I do a lot to help my colleagues, and I'm excited about the opportunity to keep contributing. But there's a lot of different areas where I've legislated or advocated based on something I've heard from a Delawarean. Every week, I get a detailed report of every email, call, letter that we've received. And in a few instances where just one Delawarean has sent me an email saying, will you consider sponsoring this bill or will you consider voting against this bill, it's actually changed the outcome in terms of my office and my votes. So more than anything, I want to keep working for Delawareans.
Let's talk about some of these issues now. And we'll start with the pandemic itself and just broadly how well you feel the federal government, specifically Congress, has done in responding to the COVID-19 pandemic. And I guess more specifically than that, even if there are still no readily available vaccines or well-established treatments by the end of this year heading into next year, what should Congress be prioritizing post-election in terms of this pandemic?
Well, that's a great question, a complex one. Let me first say that the federal government's response overall has been chaotic and has frankly made this pandemic worse in terms of its impact than it needed to be. There's a lot of work to be doing going forward in terms of strengthening our national stockpile, onshoring the manufacturing of critical medical equipment and active pharmaceutical ingredients. I've been doing both legislating and a series of meetings in both those areas. And I think we should be prioritizing making sure that high-quality, reliable testing is universally available in the United States with quick results. President Trump has been saying for 6 months now that anyone who wants a test can get one. And it's still not true that anyone who wants an effective, reliable test where you get a prompt answer can get one. And those additional qualifications are critical. Folks can get a test, for example, in Washington, D.C., if they're willing to pay $150 out of pocket. And they'll get an answer, but it'll be 8 to 10 days later. The other advanced societies, the other developed advanced economies that have made great progress in flattening the curve have done so by very broad, near universal testing that is rapid and high quality. In Delaware, we're doing a much better job because of the partnership between the state and the county. And in Delaware, I think Governor Carney did a great job of closing quickly and then only reopening cautiously in response to the science. You also asked what we should be focusing on after the election if we don't yet have a vaccine. Three things quickly. There's real promising progress in terms of not a vaccine, but a therapeutic, like remdesivir, repurposing existing and FDA-approved medications to make COVID-19 a less deadly pandemic as it moves forward, so improving treatment and care. I've met with a number of pharma CEOs whose companies are working on rapidly developing a far better therapeutic. Second, I am optimistic that by the first quarter of next year, we will have an effective vaccine. We have to make sure that the review and approval process isn't politicized. Obviously, the November 3rd election is a deadline by which an incumbent administration would want to champion a newly approved vaccine. The head of the FDA has testified that he will not end run the normal processes for efficacy and safety. Once we have an effective vaccine, I think we need to first make sure that every American has access to one in an affordable and quick way. Vaccinating 360 million people is going to be a massive undertaking. But we also need to look at ways that we can partner globally to make sure that this vaccine is ultimately available to the whole world. I think we have a big opportunity there to show the world that the United States is not only still one of the most innovative, most competitive countries in the world, but that we also continue to have a great heart for the world and to show our humanitarian instincts.
Is there things that Congress can do to further those goals? Or is it very difficult to do that, particularly in the current political environment?
Well, I'll get specific.
Okay.
Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina is the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. He's also the chairman of the Appropriations Subcommittee, on which I serve, that funds all of our foreign aid programs. Some of the things Chairman Graham has done on the Judiciary Committee, I am very strongly opposed to. I think he has done terrible things that have caused lasting damage to the infrastructure of our federal judiciary, to the Senate, to the rules we've long observed. I think holding vacant the seat previously held by Justice Scalia in order to prevent President Obama's last nominee, the highly qualified D.C. Circuit Judge Merrick Garland, I think that was unforgivable. But he's also the lead advocate for our investing $4 billion in distributing a vaccine globally through partnerships with our closest allies. A lot of the research into this vaccine is being done in countries like, you know, Sweden and the UK and Germany, Japan and South Korea, and we can and should find a path forward, first to making sure that every American who needs one gets access to an affordable vaccine, but second to make sure that we use this moment to reinvigorate and reengage with our alliances that make sure that this vaccine gets to the whole world. Lindsay's actually going to be essential to that effort. So one of the challenges of legislating and working in a divided Congress is that often exactly the same senator who I find maddening and difficult and frustrating and whose views I strongly disagree with in one field ends up being a senator who is a close partner in another. I'll give one other example. Senator Mike Braun of Indiana, a conservative Republican from southern Indiana, the part that's a coal-generating region of Indiana. We disagree on 100 different subjects. To my surprise, he believes that climate change is real, that it's being caused by people, and we need to do something about it. And so he's the co-chair of the new, relatively new, Climate Solutions Caucus with me that we founded early this year. And we've done dozens of events together. On climate change, he is a good and reasonable partner. On many other things, he is not. But that's how Congress works. The framers set up our system so that when you get to Congress, you figure out what are the things you disagree on, what are the things you agree on, and then you figure out ways to legislate together.
Let's move on to the economic piece that you had mentioned. Obviously, the country in a recession, high levels of unemployment because of this pandemic. We'll kind of ask a similar question. What can Congress do? What role can it have in getting the economy back on track, specifically if this kind of continues to linger into 2021?
Well, Tom, I was pleased and surprised that we passed the CARES Act now just over 4 months ago unanimously. Given how divided the Senate is, given how divided the Congress is, we passed $2.3 trillion in assistance that sent $1,200 stimulus checks to 80 million families, that sent unemployment insurance, an additional $600 a week to 30 million families, that sent assistance, $1.25 billion, to the state of Delaware, to New Castle County, and to every other state. We did a lot of big things in that bill. The package that should be passed in August or September includes a comparably broad menu of aid to state and local governments, of support for schools for their safe reopening, of support for hospitals and healthcare systems, of support for broadband and access to the internet so that students who are at home and parents who are at home, you know, being required to teach them as schools are reopening very slowly, so that there's resources. Telemedicine and telehealth have become more of a reality. We actually appropriated hundreds of millions of dollars for that earlier this year, and Delaware got three grants in that program. We haven't matched that with similar investments in access to education. There is a long list of the things we can and should do, but highest priorities, protecting renters and mortgage holders from eviction and foreclosure, providing further funding for state and local governments. 1.5 million public employees have already been laid off nationwide. And these aren't just faceless bureaucrats in gray buildings. They're teachers, they're paramedics, they're nurses in county hospitals, they're folks who administer programs like unemployment insurance. So I think we should provide some support for state and local governments. And then last, something there's real bipartisan agreement on is another round of loans to small businesses, the Paycheck Protection Program, or PPP, which I had a hand in creating. I wrote the bill for the prioritized PPP, which would authorize a second round. And this goes to the very smallest nonprofits and businesses that have taken the hardest hit. Those are the sorts of things I think we should be doing. I've been working with representatives of, you know, the Republican caucus and the Democratic caucus and the administration to try and move this forward. As of when we're doing this interview, it seems to be at a real impasse. But given how many Americans are unemployed, given how many businesses are at risk of closing, given how many parents are anxious about their kids and their safety, I'm really hopeful we'll get back to the table and we'll have a chance to enact another needed, significant stimulus bill.
Is there also some things that you feel like need to be done? I guess we look a little bit beyond pandemic, post-pandemic in terms of the economy. Are there areas that need to be focused on once this kind of more urgent, these urgent things you're talking about hopefully start to recede a little bit?
Well, one of the things I'm proudest of about working closely with former Vice President Biden is a number of his policy proposals he's put out, one in particular to build back better. He's put out a bold plan that talks about how we would restore American manufacturing, how we would reinvest in infrastructure, but how we would do it in a way that would make our society more just and more inclusive. We have health equity issues we desperately need to address. We have economic opportunity issues we need to address. One of the best ways we can do that is by strengthening American manufacturing, by directing the government to buy American more, by reducing some of the tax incentives and loopholes that encourage offshoring of American manufacturing, and by doing things to actually finally deliver on something that was one of President Trump's linchpin proposals as a candidate, investing in infrastructure. It hasn't happened now in nearly 4 years. It's a bad joke the number of times the administration has said, this is infrastructure week. Well, we've got roads and bridges and tunnels and highways that are falling down or cracking all over the country. Our infrastructure has lagged far behind our competitors. Investing significantly at a point in time when interest rates are so low and there's millions of people who need work, and the work that's involved in rebuilding our infrastructure to make our country more resilient in the face of climate change and to address access and equity challenges, I think know, that'd be a home run. I think there's ways we could build back better that would make our country stronger for the long term.
You talked at the top also about the racial equity issues that, this country is kind of grappling with right now. And we've seen the protests throughout the spring and summer focused on these issues. The topics of debate on this have really run the gamut from removal of monuments and renaming sports teams to really reforming police, addressing disparities in areas like education and housing. What do you feel Congress's role is in addressing some of these issues, and where should its focus be?
Well, Congress, you know, historically, when it's acted to try and address, for example, inequities and inequalities in education, has a limited but an important role. It was federal action that ultimately forced the integration of America's public schools. And just earlier today, I was at an event in Hockessin where we were recognizing the critical history, the role that Delaware played in the Supreme Court cases that ultimately brought the end of apartheid in America, of legally segregated schools. And every year, the federal government provides incentive grants for education to address equity concerns. Not as big as they should be, not as impactful as they should be, but that is a key part. In policing, we have a somewhat similar relationship. There's about 3 million police in the United States. I think it's about 19,000 agencies, and fewer than 10% of them are federal. So the Congress has the most direct impact on the policies and practices of the federal police, ATF, DEA, FBI, Federal Bureau of Corrections. But through our grants, we can have a dramatic impact on the practice of policing around the country. I'm an original co-sponsor of the Justice in Policing Act, which is led in my caucus by Senators Booker and Harris, and if enacted, would make broad and sweeping changes in policing and in the equity of policing. Compared to many other states, Delaware is already making progress on some of the key issues around policing, but I think there's a lot of concern that it's not making progress fast enough. And I think having federal partners who are actively engaged, who are providing some push and some support for transitions so that, for example, universally worn body cameras are a reality, not a point of discussion, such that the Federal Department of Justice is empowered to actually do investigations of police departments that have long records of police abuse or of inappropriate police behavior. Those are some of the many features of this bill that I think could make a lasting difference here in Delaware and for our country.
You mentioned at the top as well, there was a lot of other issues that were out there that were, you know, before this pandemic, really deemed urgent and now have kind of been pushed to the back burner. I'm curious, as you look at that spectrum of issues, healthcare, immigration, climate change, I think you mentioned as well, is there one of those that you consider perhaps the most urgent of those? Is there one that has the most sense of urgency in your mind?
Well, I'd have to say climate change, Tom. The challenge with climate change, as with the COVID-19 pandemic, is that to make real progress, we have to mobilize and engage the world. We have to change behaviors here in the United States. We need coordinated federal action that also engages and mobilizes, you know, the private sector and state and county and city governments. And the work I've done over a number of years in the Senate lays the groundwork for that. I was actually part of the congressional delegation that went to the global climate talks that resulted in the Paris Agreement. And I was at a global conference the day that President Trump pulled us out of this agreement. I think a Biden administration would promptly return us to not just participation in that agreement, but leading on climate. I think there are real opportunities for us to create a generation of new high-paying jobs and opportunity in the United States as we transition towards new types of cars and trucks, new types of power generation. And I think we also have to be attentive to the long-term impacts on other states that are really fossil fuel resource dependent, states like Montana and North Dakota and Wyoming and West Virginia. One of the things that I find hardest is that all the advances, all the progress that the Obama-Biden administration made on tackling climate, on, you know, promoting clean air and clean water, virtually all of them have been repealed or rolled back or removed in the last 4 years. I just saw a notice today that the EPA is now beginning to get rid of the methane emissions rule that the Obama-Biden administration spent years putting into place. Methane is one of the heaviest of the climate change-causing pollutants. So Look, there's lots of other things that are much more urgent for people's daily lives. Addressing opioid addiction, addressing the price of pharmaceuticals, addressing gun violence, improving schools, they all really matter. But as someone who trained as a scientist and who spent time working in this area now for more than a decade, I think we are close to a real political breakthrough on climate in Congress, and I am optimistic that the next administration can really make us into a global leader in combating climate in a way that's sustainable and bipartisan.
I do want to touch on foreign policy and kind of even just ask basically to you, what is the biggest foreign policy issue facing this country, and what can Congress do to address it? Are there ones that when you're sitting there, you know, one or two that keep you up at night more than others?
Sure. In the same way that the pandemic went from something that many folks didn't appreciate how rapidly it was going to become a nationwide and a global problem, and it requires global cooperation for us to ultimately defeat the pandemic, so too climate change is something that requires all of humanity to play its part. In terms of the structure of America's place in the world, our relationship with our allies, and our role as the leader of the free and open societies of the world, our relationship with China is going to be the defining issue in foreign policy for this century. I led a congressional delegation to China last April. I've chaired a whole series of hearings on China back a number of years ago when I was in the majority in the Senate. And I am convinced that under Xi Jinping, they've taken a sharp turn in the last 5 years. And they are not only committing gross human rights violations within their own country, the mistreatment of the Uyghurs, a Muslim minority in the West, the repression of Hong Kong, the ways in which both religious and ethnic minorities and those who would speak out, who are journalists or democracy advocates, the way they're ruthlessly suppressed in China. They're also now exporting the techniques and the technology required for digital authoritarianism. Countries all over the world, in the developing world, are being handed the tools by China to turn off the internet, to surveil and target people within their own country who are human rights advocates or journalists. And I'm concerned that this is metastasizing quickly. As the co-chair and the founder of the Human Rights Caucus in the U.S. Senate, I've held a whole series of hearings to focus on the ways in which human rights and democracy itself is at risk around the world. So we have lots of challenges: North Korea, Iran, Russia, all of the Middle East, you know. But frankly, if we don't get our relationship with China right, if we don't figure out how to compete with China, how to stand up to some of their most abusive practices in terms of IP theft and forced technology transfer, if we can't figure out a way to rally our natural allies, the countries that share our view of human rights and the role of democracy in a free press, then frankly, everything else is going to matter a lot less because we'll be in a very different world. So I'd put top of the list getting a sustained, clear-eyed strategy for how best to engage with China.
I want to ask you a very Senate-specific question. That is, should the Senate consider doing away with the filibuster? Why or why not?
You know, I'm well known among my colleagues for having led a bipartisan letter. When President Trump was repeatedly and publicly pressuring Majority Leader McConnell to get rid of the filibuster, I joined with Senator Collins, and we got 61 senators to sign a letter saying we didn't think that was wise or appropriate. And if you think about the things the Trump administration and Mitch McConnell could have done in the last year, if all they needed was 51 votes, it's chilling. I mean, they would have rolled back virtually every environmental protection. They would have changed the right to organize. It would have changed reproductive rights. I mean, there's a great agenda that the far right would be thrilled to ram through the Senate and then the president to sign back when the House was in Republican hands. I've said publicly that I will do everything I can to reach across the aisle to try and find Republicans of goodwill who are willing to legislate in good faith on the key issues we've discussed: addressing immigration, addressing gun violence, addressing prescription drug prices, restoring our economy, and ending this pandemic. But I'm not going to sit by for 4 years and watch a Republican majority in the Senate, if that's where we are in January, or a minority in the Senate do the same thing to President Biden, if that's where we are, that they did to President Obama. I was in the Senate for the second term of President Obama. and the Republican majority used the tool of the filibuster to block or slow walk dozens of important legislative proposals. I'm very concerned about what it would mean about the structure and the balance between the House and the Senate, the executive and the legislative, if we were to get rid of it. But there are urgent matters. If Joe Biden is elected president, he will have been elected by a country that wants him to take decisive action to tackle the pandemic, to restore our economy, to address equity and injustice issues. And I'm not going to see him, you know, shackled or prevented from doing so by this relic of the laws and rules of the Senate that was most famously used by Southern conservatives to block civil rights legislation. So I did note that President Obama, in his eulogy at my friend Congressman Lewis's funeral, specifically called out this point. I will do everything I can to avoid a situation where that change is necessary, but I'm clear-eyed about the very real prospects that we will end up there.
And I do want to wrap up to give you a little bit of leeway to talk about something perhaps you want to talk about. You know, is there an issue that we haven't discussed that is not getting the attention you feel it deserves in this election cycle, and how could you or Congress address it if you're reelected?
Well, Tom, I'll talk about a bill that I've worked hard on the last 4 months, and it's rooted both in my sense of how we best meet this moment, but also how we re-energize some of what is the best in the American spirit. It's called the CORE Act. It's a bipartisan bill that now has 18 co-sponsors, and it would take the 30-year-old National Service Program, best known as AmeriCorps, that President Clinton launched, and double it in size. It would increase the living stipend that AmeriCorps members get. Right now, they get $15,000 a year, which is barely enough to live on. It would raise it to $20,000. It would increase the education award that they earn through a year of full-time service from $6,000 to $10,000. And it would double the number of positions. Republicans like this bill because it's shown real results. It's flexible. It's a partnership between local nonprofits and state government. It's not a one-size-fit-all Washington-based program. Democrats like it because the service, the work that is done by AmeriCorps members over decades addresses education inequalities, could address in this pandemic public health needs, vaccination, testing, addresses our conservation challenges. It's based in some ways on FDR's Civilian Conservation Corps program, and we have national parks in every state that need work done to make them the jewels that they should be for our nation. And it's a way to address hunger. There is an existing AmeriCorps program that partners with USDA and with food banks. So last, in some ways, the reason I'm most passionate about it is I launched and ran one of the first AmeriCorps programs in the country with the Eye of a Dream Foundation back in the early 90s. And I saw the teams of people who were serving as AmeriCorps members in our program in 10 cities around the country build real bonds across differences in background and age and education. I think when people come together in service for our country, whether it's military or civilian, overseas or at home, it gives them a clearer sense of who we all are together. And I think in this time where we see so much division, we could use both a pathway towards earned opportunity for an education for young people and a pathway towards really seeing each other and working together better for the future.
Senator Chris Coons, Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate, we thank you for your time on Candidate Conversations.
Thank you, Tom.
You can find all of our Candidate Conversations online at DelawarePublic.org and DelawareDebates.org. Candidate Conversations are part of Delaware Debates 2020, produced by Delaware Public Media in collaboration with the University of Delaware's Center for Political Communication. Thanks for listening.